Good afternoon. I'm just enjoying a quiet, peaceful afternoon in solitude near the beach in Kent. It's very grey and breezy, but it's not raining at this moment. We've had so much rain over the last 2 days, it cannot find itself anywhere to drain away. So it's rather damp out there, but I'm just contemplating stir frying chicken wok. And as an aperitif, I'm drinking a Prosecco glass full of Port de Sol, which is Tesco's answer to Wolfgang Amadeus, that is Matias Portuguese rosé, which is 10%. And it's something I've perhaps not tasted in probably 25 years, actually. It's a bit nostalgic, but I find, with my well-developed palate for wine these days, I firstly am very, very appreciative of the little effervescent bubbles throughout it. That's why I've put it into this big Prosecco glass. And the colour is magnificent. It's red, really. Very, very dark rhubarb colour. Looks sort of a bit like cranberry juice. It would be fantastic for the very first drink in these big glasses on the Christmas lunch table, honestly. And the flavour is all strawberry and rose petal. And do you know what? It's absolutely delightful. Totally undersung. And I've been drinking all these wines for all these years, and I find this utterly refreshing, really delightful, cheap as chips. I would recommend go get some and then see what you can upcycle the empty bottle as, because it's pretty nice. I mean, just a vase for carnations would be fine, or perhaps somewhere to put your quill pens, if you're a writer, of course. So, yes, Port de Sol, 10% Portugal. Utterly, utterly delightful, effervescent, and very, very lovely. So, what I'm just sitting around wondering, I've been thinking over my menu, going out of the summer, sort of al fresco season, and into the winter without knocking in on the big, heavy casseroles as yet. I don't usually do casseroles until January. So I'm just thinking, maybe some more wok stir fry and perhaps a roast chicken now and again. Some lamb would be very nice. And then I was thinking about the days around my birthday, which is in early November. I like the time of year because, it's bonfire season and you're just starting to get those slightly crisp evenings, but also the crunch, underneath your feet with the fallen leaves. It's really very pleasant. Big anorak sort of days and nights, you can get some really great star-flung skies. But I would like to open something that's very memorable, partly because I'd like to look back on this particular year, which has been a very challenging year for me, but not disagreeable. I mean, I've had some magnificent moments. I've been out on Rye Bay doing a 2-hour fishing trip, fishing for mackerel, and was able to see right away from Dover, Dungeness, right across to Eastbourne. That must be over 65 miles of coast I was able to appreciate. And there were very, very few birds, almost no fish, one tiny jellyfish, but quite a lot of butterflies like to prance around over the English Channel, oddly enough. I couldn't say whether they were French or English butterflies. That was absolutely astounding. It's one of the most glorious moments in my entire life. And yes, I would definitely like to buy a boat. So there's an ambition for me. Other fantastic moments were a good few days in York, where I met a chess IM and had some fabulous laughs and created some great piano music. You know, could always be better, but it was good with my friend. And there's been, you know, picnics in Regent's Park and visiting friends in Ipswich and going to Aldborough. That was fantastic because I had oysters for the first time on the beach at an oyster shack. And then we had chips and I had a pineapple fritter afterwards and a pint of Guinness to follow all that down. But we had two bottles of Limoux and Loire Cremant and some Suffolk cheeses as well later that evening. But it was remarkable going to Aldborough because I've got a photograph of my dad in 1959 on a bicycle with his brother, and they're cycling along the coast to Aldborough. And that brother later went to live there and lived there for many, many years. I mean, you know, 4 or 5 decades, I would think. But I had never visited Aldborough myself and had never seen, and I never did see, the brother. Although the brother was kind one year and gave me a washing machine. And another year he gave me a hamper at Christmas, which contained 6 bottles of wine, including 2 carvers, and a great deal of cake and chocolate. And that is exactly the kind of, you know, well thought out hamper I like to get. And I must admit the washing machine is very handy. So thinking about my birthday, yeah, I want to remember this particular one because it has been a sort of mixed all sorts type of year, goods and bads and uglies. And so I was just looking through what I've got available at this precise moment, and I'm thinking, what about a Pomerol from 1983? Because this is 2023, so it would be 40 years. So that would be absolutely seismic, and I think has to be done, especially as I happen to have 4 of that particular bottle and that particular vintage. So this is going to be my first Pomerol ever, and it's Chateau Lacroix Gay. I'll give you lots more details as we go. You'll be quite bored of it by the time I've finished, I'm sure. So Pomerol is a tiny appellation next to Saint-Emilion, and the most foremost grower produces some of the most expensive, most sought after wine in the world, which is called Petrus. And the remarkable thing about Petrus is it's only a tiny vineyard, but it's situated on some blue clay, which is nowhere else in the area. It's just that one vineyard is situated on this blue clay. There are other parts of the world, very, very tiny, you know, parts that have vineyards that do have blue clay. So it's well worth researching this, because if you can find a wine that is grown on blue clay, you know, even if you never ever taste Petrus, you will have an inkling as to what blue clay can do for the structure of the wines, if it does anything at all. You know, it's one of the longest arguments in the wine world. Do we really get anything from the soil, or the limestone, or the clay, or the gravel, or whatever it is, the sand, you know, that the vines are growing in? Does it really penetrate into the wine? I have a wine which is incredibly intensely structured, and it was grown entirely on sandy soil right by the beach in Sardinia. And, you know, whether or not that's contributed, I couldn't say, but it's certainly part of the legend of that wine, and it gives me a very warm feeling towards it. So the other way in which we can try to taste or get an idea of some of the great, you know, chateaus of France that we're probably not going to drink ever, unless we can, you know, get into the wallet of a wealthy friend and go out for lunch at Michael LaRue and just pop a Petrus onto the dining menu. It might go down as a business expense. Hint, hint. So, you know, Petrus is part of Pomerol. So let's try some other Pomerol. Now, that wouldn't be such a problem, but they start from kind of bottom end, absolute bottom end, £40 a bottle. So actually, one of the best ways to buy Poborol, which is, so sought after, there's much less of it made than can be sold. No, I mean, supply is less than demand, okay? So if you go to something called Ideal Wine, it's a wine auctioneer's in France, and I've actually purchased at auction 24 bottles from them. Some of them are quite new, so they were, maybe as new as 2019. And the oldest one was, I think, 1978, and that was a Bourgneuf from Pomerol. I don't anticipate that wine being delicious at all, but I just did it to have, a 70s wine in my cellar because it just makes you feel good. But I did purchase within that number quite a good number of, sturdy Pomerols, including some Chateau Villemoine, which is actually a Saint-Emilion, but it's, you can't buy it anymore because it's been bought out by Angela. So that was a very, very remarkable one, and a Clinet from 1999 as well, and a number of the various chateaus called Gabe, which there are four, in fact. I'll do an aspects all about Pomerol another day. Probably be a great subject for Christmas, I think. But yeah, don't ever give up and say to yourself, I'm never going to be able to taste some of the really great wines of the world. Find out how you can approximate them. I mean, I'm a confrere for Laithwaite's Le Clairière, and for £24 a bottle, you're getting like 30, 40 to £50 wine. So, I buy six of those every year, and they cost me, I think they cost about £18 now, I'm not quite sure, per bottle. But it's an immense wine for a very ridiculously small price. And so there are lots and lots of ways in to find out what some of the depth of Bordeaux can really be. The ordinary Bordeaux's for about 8 to £14 won't give you any idea at all as to how fantastic this region's wines truly can be. And don't forget that they have, high tannins and therefore very long drinking windows. So if you drink something that's 5 years old or less, you're probably not getting any idea as to what that wine can be like. But if you buy Waitrose's cheapest Merlot Bordeaux off the shelf, I recommend you drink it, next week latest. But the general idea of Bordeaux is that they're some of the longest lived wines in the world. Probably nothing can ever quite outlive a Madeira. So what I was really wanting to talk about today, and I know I do speak at some length, but you can see I'm quite relaxed with my Port de Sol here and my black cat on my lap. She's not actually on my lap. She's never on my lap. She prefers sitting on my bosom because it seems to be quite a shelf for her, and she finds it warm and comforting indeed. So I was just really thinking this week about wine ratings. Jancis Robinson, British, she has a rating system up to 20. Whether or not she's ever rated something at 20, I couldn't absolutely say. But when I look at the Rhone Entrepreneur notes, I notice her ratings a lot. And I notice that they almost all weigh in between 15 and a half and 17. Occasionally one gets a 17 plus. So in effect, she's only working along, 15 and a half, 16, 16 and a half, 17. You could say she's only actually rating on a four-star system. literally. Of course, some things go in and out of those, but if she bothers to rate it at all, it's almost always 15 and a half to 17, and it's almost always based on price as well. So, you know, if it's costing £12 a bottle, £15 a bottle, it might be a 15 and a half, but if it's £400 a bottle, you know, it might shift up towards the 17 and a half or 17 plus, something like that. She's not the most generous person with her ratings, but the thing is that when you're choosing between wines at a similar price and you're not sure which village to go for, you are going to think, oh, Genesis has rated this one over this one, or she hasn't rated this one at all. And it gives you a sort of warm feeling to think that you're going to buy a wine which Genesis herself has appreciated. Now, the reality is that all these superstars in the wine world have, you know, an office full of people just tasting for them, so she's probably never tasted the wine in her life. But there you go. So her ratings, you know, are just like a stamp of approval to my mind. I don't take them seriously. I just think, oh, Genesis has rated this Rhone. So Parker and Suckling and Baum and, you know, most of the international wine masters of wine, they say that they mark on a sophisticated 100 points scoring system. But I've looked well into this, and I would honestly say almost all the wines scored fall between 88 and 97. Very, very rare that any wine gets higher or lower than that. So therefore, they're actually only working on a 10-star system. It sounds fantastically sophisticated. Oh, I rate this 93 points. No, it's not 93 points, is it? It's 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93. It's 6 stars out of 10, actually. So, you know, whenever you're talking about numbers, always think about statistics and things. There's always a catch in there with numbers, always. So, you know, Genesis is peddling along on 4 stars, and they're really just working within 10 stars. That's all they're actually doing. And what is the point? It means nothing to me whether a wine is 88, 91, 93 or 97. It doesn't mean a thing because I don't know what any of it means. I've never grown up alongside of this rating system. And, you know, what the heck? You've given a wine, any wine, all over the world, something out of a possible 10. It makes no sense. So the only ratings that I've ever had anything to do with is the ratings that Leif Waits ask you to review the wines, and that they do it on a 5-star system. Now, the reason why I mention this is that over the years, about 8 years it's taken me, I've become Leif Waits' number one contributor. So I am the top wine reviewer. So I have rated or starred more wines than anyone else who buys wines from the club, or from this particular club. And what I do is I gauge the rating on the wine as the wine is presented. So almost everything I give either 4 points or 5 points to nowadays. If it can't get 4 points, I phone up Leif Waits and I ask for a refund because there's clearly something faulty with the wine. And the reason I say that is I'm very, very meticulous about what I order. I don't order wild cards. I don't order random things. I consider very, very carefully based on the location, the terroir, the shape of the bottle, the look of the label, the price, and particularly the grapes. Am I likely to like the wine? Am I going to give it at least 4 out of 5 stars? And that's the criteria before I even have it delivered to me. So obviously a 5-star Côte Rôtie is not in the same league as a 5-star South African blend, which cost me a tenner. So why would I rate them both 5 stars? Because I'm rating the wine on its own personal merit, okay? So I look at how much it cost me compared to the kind of enjoyment that it gives. I mean, it's very, very rare that you're going to get the enjoyment of a £20 wine from a £10 wine, that type of thing. But you could easily get the enjoyment of a £10 wine from a £5 wine if it had been discounted, say. So the sort of enjoyment value and how well the wine seems to be made, whether it's disappointed me at all. I mean, just occasionally I buy a very dark looking bottle and it turns out to be a very pale see-through red, and it wasn't the type of wine I thought it was at all, and then I'll find that a bit disappointing and give it a 4 stars. But it's not worth any less than that because it will be a decent wine. It just wasn't the wine I thought it was going to be, that's all. You've got to remember that Laithwaites themselves have, tasted maybe 80,000 wines to choose 800 over some time, obviously. But, they themselves are very meticulous and try their best not to let any kind of garbage, sneak onto the catalogue. So the wines are going to be very, very good. And so I take a look at, the price, literally. If it was £7, I'd judge it as a £7 wine. If it was £10, I'd judge it as a £10 wine. If it was £14, as a £14 wine. I've, consumed so many bottles at all the different price ranges, I know exactly what I expect. And of course, a large amount of it is me judging it on what I think, so it's my personal taste. But I do have an incredibly broad palate and a great appreciation of all the different styles of wine. There are very few styles of wine that I absolutely avoid. And I will drink lots of different types of ones during the different seasons. So I'll drink a lot of Beaujolais in June because I can enjoy it with strawberries. But I'll drink perhaps South Africa in September, Italian in October, and then I start on the Rhones and the Bordeaux for November and December. And there'll probably be a really good Argentine Malbec snuck in there, and perhaps some Portuguese as well. So I want the bigger, full-bodied wines in the colder months. Most of the wines that I rate these days get 5 stars. And if you look at my contributor table, you'll see that my average rating is 4.9 out of 5 stars. They're excellent wines, it comes at a certain price. Somebody's taken an awful lot of effort to put that wine together. Having spent a day bucket running on a vineyard for 9 hours, I appreciate even more how much effort goes into the wine, and it does seem nothing less than churlish to give a wine only 3 stars. If I think a wine is likely to be a type of 3-star wine, the bottom end of the market wines, then I just don't buy them because, why would I want to? I want to enjoy the wine. I'm not buying it in order to rate it. I just happen to rate it, So I do that, but I'm only essentially rating within a 2-star system, which is 4 or 5 out of 5. It's just an approval, really. So I don't have any desire myself to rate wine. Occasionally on a tweet I might say, oh, this is a 7 out of 5 star wine. I'm just trying to say this is really something totally exceptional, to draw attention to it. What I try to do instead is to provide some colourful information that's entertaining, a little bit educational, to help you embrace and broaden your comfort zone. Embrace a lot more wines and the possibility of enjoying a lot more wines. Don't be afraid to try wines that you might not enjoy so much, because the more you go out on a limb, the more wines you are going to discover. And I promise you, one day you will discover a wine that you don't know as yet, but it's much, much nicer than the wines you do know. That's an absolute cert. There's a wine out there for everyone that's much nicer than any other wine I've ever tasted. So why would you not try and find that one? It's a little bit like relationships. That was, of course, very naughty of me. One should always try to be circumspect and faithful, of course, is very, very important. But nonetheless, just saying. So I spent a great deal of time doing these duos. So I do a duo red on a Friday and a duo white on a Sunday. Okay. And within that, I try to judge the wines entirely on their own merits within that moment. So I don't do an awful lot of research about them. I don't talk a great deal about the terroir or the grapes or anything. I'm just trying to say how they come across at that moment, bearing in mind, you know, the temperature, the type of day it is, what food maybe I'm having or whatever. But I'm just trying to judge the wines entirely on their own merits at that precise moment. And hopefully these are both useful and enjoyable and will encourage you to try not only more wines, but, you know, earlier I opened two white Australia. One was a Viognier and one was a Chardonnay. I'm not entirely sure that I've ever had a Viognier or a Chardonnay from Australia, and apart from the very, very cheap Tesco's Australians for £4, you know. So they were very pleasant tasting and they complemented one another magnificently. Not my favourite style of wine, but both of them were definitely worth their 5 out of 5 stars based on what they were trying to achieve, how much they cost and everything. And the labels were incredibly beautiful as well, I thought. Not that that matters, but it does, you know, clearly if someone's put a fantastic label on a bottle of wine, they themselves pride themselves so much on the contents of the bottle. Occasionally, I'll do a wine review that's just one wine on its own, like this Pomerol will be. And they are what I think of wow ones. You know, they're so wow, particularly Bordeaux's. I just want to share the one bottle with you. I did do the Tempranillo from Australia last week or so. That was a particularly very, very good find. I was thrilled with that one. Very fulsome wine. And well worth, you know, highlighting on its own. Then I do aspects like this. So I'm trying to take you a bit deeper into the considerations of the wine world in all sorts of different ways. I do my wine and dine. That's very, very much in its infancy. But eventually I hope to be able to do it at a proper kitchen and, you know, open the wine and prepare a meal and everything within the length of a video. I think that'd be a totally fantastic series once a week, but I'm just scratching the surface of that at the moment. But wine and dine is massively important. I mean, you're either going to, you know, dine with the wine or you're just glugging it. And what, you know, it's interesting to know what goes well and what people pair with food and wine. I mean, quite a lot lately I've been drinking red wine with battered white fish. It's brilliant. Honestly, it's a really good combination. Don't let anyone say that red wine doesn't go with fish or that you should only have Pinot Noir. That's nonsense. I've been drinking really hefty Italian blends and Bordeaux as well with fish. Fantastic. And then it's a little bit in its infancy, but I'm trying to do some nice videos of music and wine. So, you know, what sort of music does this wine make me feel like? What does it inspire? And then particularly important, I think, is cellar and buying tips. You know, how can you get better wine? How can you get more discounts? How can you get onto the lists where all the very best bargains come your way and all that sort of thing? And how on earth do I manage to buy so much wine, so much quality wine, so incredibly inexpensively? And I have to admit, so far, I have not actually let anyone into the precise nature of how I achieve it. But this is material perhaps for a subscriber series or a tips secrets ebook later. You know, I think personally just having a very deep enjoyment of the wine world is, you know, it's absolutely essential for my personal enjoyment of life. I'm the ultimate wine armchair traveller. I don't want to go abroad, just let me open a wine.